G'day, folks. Talk to Sean Wood, an Australian pioneer in the parkour scene. We talk about the origins, where it all started in Paris, France, and to where it is now on the international stage. And also the competition scene internationally, and where it's looking at going to the Olympics, and some of the controversy with some of the big gymnastics organisations trying to muscle in. And he's a teacher in the Movement Collective up in Newcastle and a co-founder of Team Farang, a group of international parkour professional athletes. Awesome yarn, great guy, can feel the energy when he comes in the room. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Sean Woods.
Hello.
I'll start again. Mr. Sean Wood.
That's the one. There's no S on it.
I know. Yeah. Thanks for coming down, brother, from Newcastle. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Parkour athlete. Impressive stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of skills involved. And I want to, from your perspective, give a breakdown to the listeners and the viewers what parkour is.
Yeah.
And just where it's originated from and a bit of a background on that, brother.
Yeah, I always get a little bit caught up trying to explain it because there's so many directions to go with an explanation. I guess in the media, they call it an extreme sport. Us that practice it don't consider it that. We consider it a bit more of a discipline, like a martial art. So these days it is more considered a sport, but some of us that have been practicing a long time, yeah, we'd like to see it a bit more as a discipline. Probably seen some of these crazy viral videos on the internet of people jumping between buildings. A little bit of a misconception. A lot of us don't train like that. So in its essence, we say that it's...
Because that's pretty high risk stuff.
It is pretty high risk stuff. And yeah. I've done some of that myself. But it's not how we train every day.
Got to live on the edge, brother.
That's definitely... taste the fear. That's the one. We like to say that it's... in its essence, getting from A to B through like an urban environment, or it could be nature as well, but getting from A to B in the most efficient way possible. So if you were standing at one edge of a building and you wanted to get to the other side of the road or the path, finding the sort of quickest, most efficient route would be sort of at its core what parkour is. But beyond that, it's kind of like a training methodology of how to make that happen. So obviously it came through, or maybe not obviously, some people might just be hearing it here, but it came from the sort of slums of Paris in the late 90s, early 2000s. Right. And I like to say that it's kind of, I think parkour would have sparked up somewhere else around the world around the same time if it hadn't have come from Paris. And that's because I feel like it's our response to urbanization in a way that, you know, it's a very primal way of moving. As humans, we have this desire to move and to jump and to run. That's why we all do it when we're kids.
Yeah.
You know, and yep. And then we've built these big concrete cities around us, yeah. But we've still got that like intuitive feeling deep within our psyches that we want to do these things. Yeah. So
we've gone back from thousands of years, like living within forests and the bush and everything else. Now we've built up these concrete jungles. So it's like, how do we navigate through this?
Exactly. So we've still got this innate desire to do these things. So these really urbanized places, like some of these slums in Europe, these kids have started mimicking what they'd seen. Like the founder, David Bell, his dad was in... had done some French military training in the Vietnam War, and you know, he wanted to be like his father, and so these kids started playing and copying these things they saw, and it started as games as first, and then they got really good and started jumping between two brick walls, and then suddenly yep. they've they've gotten really good, and the French media starts filming them, and it just blows up and creates this worldwide craze. But
and talking about the craze, like the first time I really got a view of this,
yeah,
way back, years and years and years ago, it was a film, Yamikaze.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
So the Yamikaze were with David. So they were all, these are the kids that I'm talking about. Yeah. You know, they were some of the founding members of the sport. They sort of went off into their different directions, but...
So it was a group, like a team.
Yeah, they were all a bunch of young kids, teenagers that trained together. And David and this guy, Sebastian, went off and created their own little things. And then the Yamikaze did their own thing as well. And all of them... What really inspired them earlier on was stunts, and they all wanted to be actors and stuntmen, which is why they've all done films. But
you see it a lot now in films.
Oh, Hollywood is dominated by parkour. Like the stunt industry, I know Batman's stunt double. I know Superman's stunt double. I know the guy that did stunts in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, like it's all parkour athletes these days. But I just want to say, just going back to the urbanization and sparking off anywhere in the world. I have some friends who went to the favelas in Brazil not that long ago.
Jeez, right.
Yeah, and what was really interesting is these kids had never seen, they don't have access to the internet, they'd never seen parkour before. And my friends walked into these favelas and saw these kids doing parkour. And they went up to them and said, oh, you guys are doing parkour. And the kids were like, no, we're doing this. And they, in Brazilian, they named this different thing.
And it's a different version of parkour,
it was their own version, right? It was
Never knew of it.
They never knew about parkour. So that's why I feel like it's this like innate like instinct that we have to do these things, because these kids from Brazil are doing the same things that the kids from Paris were doing 30 years ago, you know, and it's never had any exposure to each other. So I feel like that's why it's so been so popular and such a viral sport. Outside of, I think people just like watching people hurt themselves. So the high risk.
You see that parkour fail, you know.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. So that's helped to the virality. But then also because it's relatable to everybody. We all know what it was like to jump around in the park when we were kids.
That's it.
You know, like skateboarding.
Swinging on the monkey bars and, you know, going for that extra bar and, you know, going for that extra length and trying to flip around. Or even being on a swing set. And learning to, you know, to backflip out of it and
That's it. And maybe we're just the kids that never grew up and we got really good at swinging, doing backflips off the swings. That's basically what we are. But
Still.
So that's sort of my version of what parkour is.
Your version. So if we go the start of your journey.
Sure.
And how'd you find out about it? And like, how's it helped you lot with the sport lifestyle and just, you know, not just physically, but mentally.
Yeah. So I grew up here on the Central Coast in a small town called Summerland Point. And so not a very urbanized place, actually nature, surrounded by nature. Grew up on the beaches but my school was, I went to Lake Memorial High School and we used to joke that it was a jail because it had like these 12-foot walls that surround us in, and every day they would sort of shut the gates behind us and it felt like we were in a jail cell for the rest of the day. Ironically, I actually managed to get over those 12-foot walls at one point. I grew up here on the Central Coast and I was one of those kids that saw the Yamikaze and these viral videos online before YouTube quite early on. And as I said, I saw it and I'd always wanted to learn to backflip. For me, my best mate used to always line up bins at school and we were the weird kids that were jumping over like 7 garbage bins at school. And so we were already kind of doing parkour.
Yeah.
But then I found these people online that were doing what I thought was nothing. And it was suddenly they'd given meaning to it.
Yep.
And I just latched onto it. I was a super sporty kid. I'd played soccer, football, basketball, every sport, you know, and was pretty good at most of them. But then when I found this sport parkour, and it was like this sort of, in team sports, I got a little bit frustrated sometimes because you didn't always get directly what you put in. So you could play really well and the team could still do bad.
Mm.
So that kind of got frustrating for me. But
so
then
you wanted to take it on your own. And so if it's you fail, you fail. If you don't, you don't.
Exactly. Yeah. So that kind of appealed to me early on. And then I learned to backflip on the beach up here on the Central Coast. And then started traveling down to Sydney to meet up with a group of guys that were training down there. And somehow now I'm 30 years old and I've been doing it 15 years. And there's been this crazy journey that's gone on in between all of that.
Yeah, right. So it was, so you were starting out with people on the coast. Like, so did you source like other, you know, familiar people around the coast that were getting into the scene, or you saw people doing it in Sydney or up in Newcastle and were reaching out to these people to try and further your skills in this discipline? Or
yeah, well, when I started, man, there was probably 100 people in Australia that were practicing parkour, maybe less. And I would say there's about a handful of those people that are 15 years still training. So in a way, I was part of probably close to the first generation of parkour athletes here in Australia.
Yeah, right.
So there was no one else on the coast doing what I was doing. There was a couple of guys in Newcastle that I used to go up and see.
Yep.
And then outside of that, there was a very small online forum and community in Sydney. But I was like 14 and 15 at that time. And yep. I used to just catch the train down on the weekends and sometimes skip school and catch the train down. But it was so far away, you know. Sydney's an hour and a half train trip. Mm. And I was 14 years old. So really it was me and my best mate, Boris, just training on the coast and watching videos online and trying to copy them.
Shout out to Boz.
Yeah, that's it. He'll be watching for sure.
Yeah. So, like, Yamikaze.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know if you'd if you'd say if it's a team or just a general group of people. So when you were 14 and you were sourcing out and reaching out, were some of these groups forming themselves, like with the girls and guys, as teams and names and all that sort of stuff? Or
yeah, the team stuff didn't really start with it. It wasn't really a part of the sport very early on. It was kind of like this internet forum. There was a couple of internet forums, Urban Freeflow and another website called parkour.net. And they were the two sources of information, translated information, because all the early stuff was in French. And then there's a few people that could translate it online. And we had these two forums, Urban Freeflow and parkour.net. And that's where the rest of us in the world would go to sort of source out information on how to train. And then we'd all share videos that we were making at the time as well. And it was like this community. Urban Freeflow became a team. I was one of their sponsored athletes. So this was like 13 or 14 years ago. I was like 16 and I got sponsored by this team in London. And it was like this really cool thing. I was like, yeah, I'm getting sponsored. He sent me like a couple of shirts. That was my sponsorship. But it meant a lot to me like 14. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Something.
And then eventually there was these guys, Three Run, who started this team and they become
this... Heard of Three Run.
Yeah, you would, yeah. And they started this... They did this video, Two Brothers, and it blew up. And then they started getting a lot of work doing performances for like big car companies and lots of corporate gigs. So this sort of team thing started because originally teams were people wanting to get together to do performances. And then the competitive scene started... And Red Bull got involved in the sport, and just this normal, this natural progression happened where we started doing teams. And yeah, I got together a couple of my friends that I met from sport and created a team called Team Farang. And then there was a team called Storm Free Run, and they're all still active right now. And
yep.
So now it's a more of a team sport, not in the way that soccer's a team sport where you all play together.
No.
But it's just more of a, I guess you find what your vibe attracts your tribe, they say. And so you find the people that are a bit like yourself that want the same sort of thing out of the sport. For us, it was like creating culture. We wanted to create the culture of parkour and direct where that went. So there was like three of us that really had a very, very similar direction we wanted to see the sport go. And it was kind of parallel with skate culture. And so we banded together.
Yeah, just individualized, you know. I'm sick of this team sport stuff. Like,
exactly.
You know, 'cause everybody's not playing on the same field and you sort of want to just run your own path. So it's like, let's jump in and have a crack.
Yeah. We wanted to do this culture building stuff. So we wanted to see like clothing and certain style of videos, and we were all sort of filmmakers as well. And so we just had this vision of where we wanted to see parkour go. So we were like, let's start a team. And then Storm Free Run, for instance, you know, they were making these really cool viral videos at the time. So they were kind of, and they were amazing athletes. So they really banded together and created their own thing. And yeah, there's like another team, Modus, that had come along, and it was started by an old school guy as well, and he like helped. He was the first company that was sponsoring younger athletes. So now he has this the next generation.
Yep.
So teams aren't so much like a team sport thing, but more of a way of connecting with people that are similar to you.
Okay. And talking about vision, so wherever you're at, if it's, you know, in Australia or if you just generalizingly training or if you're overseas or wherever you're at, so... when you're talking about what you said earlier, going from A to B,
yeah,
and the line, what's the method? Like, how do you run through the method? Like, do you just go, like you sort of see it and go full blast, or do you walk through? Do you visualize it? How does that come across?
Yeah, there's definitely, because of the online video culture, there's definitely a part of parkour that looks reckless, and it looks like that people are trying these moves for the first time when you see these videos, but it's definitely a lot more preparation gone into it than what you see. It would be quite reckless and unsafe to just bomb a rooftop run for the first time.
That's what I mean, like, because you see some people that seriously hurt themselves or that pull it off. And that's one of the main moves that you see in a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Where I don't know the name of the move, but it's when you're jumping off the building, but where you take the impact into a roll and then keep running.
So there'll be a parkour roll.
Yeah.
And I guess it's one of the fundamental moves that you learn very early on is how to roll properly, because what I like to say is if you're ever jumping from above your head height, you want to roll. You know, the mechanics of your knees and the way that your body works, you don't want to go past like a 45 degree angle with your knees. So anytime that the impact's going to require you to bend your knees more than that, you chuck a roll into it.
Yeah, because it seems like an efficient way to take impact, when you're coming from a height, to take it in, and the way that distributes through your body to take it within the roll and then to keep the momentum, keep going forward.
Yeah, from a practical standpoint, I guess that parkour is really about how you mitigating the energy forces, right? So if you're moving at an obstacle, what's the best way to hit that obstacle and disperse the impact in a way that isn't taken in your body.
Yep.
So if you're jumping from overhead height, a roll is the best way to move that forward, move the force forward rather than straight downwards. If you were to just jump straight down and land on your heels, that energy has to go through your body and it's really bad for your body. But if you land on your toes and you roll forward, then you're taking the downward force and you're moving it forward, and a lot of it's minimal impact on your body.
Yep.
So really that's what the training, when you're moving through as efficiently as possible, that's what the training's really about. It doesn't always work like that. I'm actually a bit injured right now because I took a really big jump on my heels. So that's really what the training comes down to, is building techniques in ways to move as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, because the shock just would have went through your back.
Exactly.
All that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But mate, so you're a veteran.
Yeah.
So... talking about, and you would have seen the evolution of it coming through Australia. So, competitions, how do they work? And are there localized ones? How does it work on the national circuit?
Yeah.
And you're talking about teams.
Yeah.
So, how does that work? And, like, is there a point system? Like,
Sure. So, parkour competitions currently work a lot like your freestyle sports, so your skateboarding, your inline skating, where it's sort of like a four judge system, and it's like creativity, flow, execution, and difficulty, and there's a fourth category that I can't think of right now. And each judge has one criteria that they judge, and then there's like you compound all the score and the person with the highest score wins. So that's one format that's currently really popular. The other format would be there's two more formats now, a speed competition. So imagine like a 100-meter sprint, but with obstacles.
So that's
really popular as well. And then there's a skill-based competition where there's a bunch of challenges set up in a parkour park.
Yep.
And you have a certain amount of time to hit those challenges, and the people that hit them, you know, who rack up the most points over that time usually win that as well.
Right.
So they would be the three main competition formats. There was a lot of competition wasn't really supported for parkour. Like the community really didn't like it for a long time.
Why the perception of, because
as I mentioned earlier, it was like seen as more of like a martial arts discipline, and it was like a self practice rather than a team sport early on. Mm-hmm. A lot of people didn't see the philosophy matching up with the, you know, competition being about being the best and winning. It didn't align with a lot of people's values of parkour at the early stages. Once Red Bull came in and hosted these really cool competitions, I guess some of the older generation, their voices weren't quite listened as much. The next generation come through, did competition, everyone took it on, and now it's accepted that competition is a thing within parkour. Now we've got a new villain within the sport. So Red Bull was once upon a time the villain of parkour. We're okay with Red Bull now. Now we have...
What is it, Monster or Rockstar?
No, it's actually the World Gymnastics Federation.
What?
So it's very interesting, actually. They're called FIG. And now they're like the new supervillain for parkour, and that's what everyone's against. So everyone's okay with Red Bull now, and now we're fighting the FIG. So the reason people don't like it is because gymnastics, this is what people say online. I don't quite believe it, but people are saying...
Is it because they're thinking like some of the gymnasts are starting out as within gymnastics itself, and they get a little bit of taste of parkour, and then they're jumping over to you guys on that side of the fence? Or,
well, this doesn't quite reflect my opinion. I'll just say what I hear online.
Okay.
So what people are saying is that gymnastics numbers are at an all-time low. I don't know. I haven't had it fact-checked, but this is what people are saying.
You parkour thieves.
Well, apparently all the kids want it these days. They want to do parkour. So Gymnastics Worldwide Federation has seen an opportunity to take up a young sport very early, with the end goal of getting it into the Olympics. So if...
Wait up, hold on.
Yeah, we've skipped a bit.
Did you just say parkour Olympics?
Yes. So this is the situation that we're in, because for me, that sounds cool. Like, I would love to see parkour in the Olympics. I grew up in Australia where like being an Olympic athlete is like the highest accolade that you can have.
And I grew up skateboarding.
Yeah.
It's going to be in the Olympics.
Exactly.
Tokyo.
And we're like 20 years younger than skateboarding is. And we're already being talked about it. So there's like this.
And just going back to skateboarding quickly, Shane O'Neill, come on, get some gold, son.
There we go, Shane O'Neill. Yeah. Win it for us. But that's it, right? Like, this is where I'm a bit conflicted, and my opinion doesn't quite reflect the rest of the parkour community, because, like, if I was to go to tell my nan that I'm doing parkour in the Olympics, like, that would be the greatest honor I could do for my family, right? I'd be so proud.
That's your passion.
Exactly. But I do see the perspective of the people that are against it, and this is that FIG is this huge organization. We can see through the reasons. They don't care about parkour. They're already wanting to systemize it. They're already wanting to put systems in place to say that people who have been teaching parkour for 10 years would have to go through their certifications to then teach parkour. The insurances would change. People that run gyms already would have to be under these new qualifications to teach. And FIG's like coming in pretty hard with this stuff. Like, they're like stamping their foot down and saying, like, we own parkour now.
So are you trying to go to the Olympic Committee and trying to formalise something underneath that, or formalise some other sort of, I wouldn't, like a union or a federation to sort of look after you guys?
I think what people would rather is, I think people have widely accepted that parkour competition is a thing now, and they're okay with it, and that one day it might end up in the Olympics. But what the community wants is for us to do it ourselves, you know, and not have this bigger organization that clearly doesn't care about parkour come in and just say, hey, we own parkour now, and now we're going to put it in the Olympics under a scoring system that we created, not something that reflects the community. So it's like they're not talking to us. They haven't come to us and said, hey, parkour community, like, let's do this together. They've come in back with David Bell, the guy that we talked about earlier, who was the founder. They got him on board. And this is a whole conversation.
They got him on board.
They did. And this is a whole conversation itself, because he doesn't...
Is he getting a few dollars slipped in the back pocket, or what's going on there?
Well, there's that. And unfortunately, because as I mentioned, he wanted to be a stuntman. That was his... Or he wanted to be a stunt actor. That was his main thing. This community started underneath David Bell without him being involved. So he created this sport accidentally almost. And then it became this huge thing that hundreds of thousands of people did around the world, but he wanted nothing to do with it. He never came to events. He never had anything to do with the parkour community. He really stayed away from it as much as he could. Like,
why?
Because he has his own backstory that's quite traumatic. His dad died at quite a young age. I can understand. When you hear his story, you empathize for him. You say, he's had it tough, and he wasn't equipped for this worldwide fame that he was stumbled across, right?
Okay.
He was this kid from the slums of Paris who accidentally created a worldwide sport and didn't know how to handle it.
Yep.
But now, 20 years later, the sport's popular, and the World Gymnastics Federation comes to him and says, oh, hey, we want to get parkour in the Olympics. And he goes, oh, sure. The thing is, he doesn't represent the community. He doesn't have anything to do with us. So it's almost like he can't do that because it's not his sport anymore. He wanted nothing to do with it. And so he sold parkour to FIG and we don't want it. So
So what? He's somehow got some IP on parkour and sold it? Or what's the go there? How can you just sell it to FIG? And well, now this massive federation is like, yeah, we've got this.
This is the
money
argument.
Money grab.
Exactly. So this is, now you understand why the community doesn't want it. And I'm in the middle because I definitely love this parkour community and love all these people that are fighting against it. But at the same time, I wouldn't mind seeing it in the Olympics, you know. But I definitely have had some really good conversations with some people that know a lot more about this than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be a lot better for us to do it ourselves rather than have FIG involved. Their intentions on the surface seem good, but when you dig a little bit deeper and see what they've done to other sports that are a bit like parkour, or what organizations like this have done to sports, mm-hmm. like snowboarding went through something similar with their, like the Ski Federation, and I believe skateboarding had a version of this that it went through. When you see these...
And the thing is, like, if we're looking at skateboarding, right?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't cost that much to get set up compared to if you look... And now that's going to be in the Olympics.
Yeah.
Right? And skateboarders aren't... You know, they might be going to indoor skate parks where they pay a few dollars here and there, and then some kids eventually get sponsored,
yeah,
and then it grows from that. But that's not a whole lot of money compared to if you're looking at kids that are going through gymnastics,
yeah,
from a young age. You know what I mean? And the money that parents
well, then parkour is even cheaper.
That's what I'm getting to. You know, the kids that where the parents are pulling out massive dollars to keep them in these schools to do the roll and tumble, and then it grows into.
And this is what people are worried about, that that's going to become parkour. Suddenly you're going to have to buy an outfit to do parkour, that's and you're going to have to buy parkour shoes to train at a gymnastics gym. And it's like
$100 a week to do the park.
I feel like what would be the best way to explain it is that and this would reflect the opinion of some people within the community, is that we're too young for this right now. We don't know. We don't even have the best judging system set up. There's huge controversy going on within the Red Bull. There's the Art of Motion, which is our biggest competition, is going to be happening next month. And there's huge controversy. It's in Italy this year.
Okay.
And there's huge controversy going on because of the judging system and the way that it was done.
Because they want to try and formalize it a bit more so it's as standard.
Well, we're starting to grow. Well,
you're going to have to do that before it gets to the Olympics anyway.
Exactly. So. And we've kind of we created this judging system out of necessity. It was like, we need a judging system, so we just created one. It's not working the best. So these athletes have made it into the parkour. Some of the community are upset about it. And so now we're going through revisions of what the judging system should be like. My point is that we're still going through, we're so young, we're still going through these types of teething issues, and now we're being pushed into the Olympics. Give us another 10 years and let us get our shit together first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we 100%. Might be ready for that. You know,
that makes sense, because then if you look back at skateboarding and you look at the X Games and how that was built and the judging system and how that's grown.
Yeah.
And that took a long time.
Yeah.
And now, boom, Olympics.
X Games has done it all for, like, now it's ready for the Olympics.
It's created the path.
Exactly. We don't have the X Games yet. We've got Art of Motion and some really good community competitions that happen.
And strictly Red Bull competitions, or...?
They're not. There's some of my friends who have created their own competitions that are on a level just as good as some of the Red Bull competitions. And this is where parkour has been exciting, is because everything, we didn't have, if you know anything about the Z Boys, the early skateboard, the first generation,
they
got the corporates come in and hit them hard real early. We managed to push some of the corporates out really early, and we've done a lot of it
Have
ourselves.
You watched Dogtown?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep, I definitely, in the early days of us and me and my friends starting our team, we wanted to replicate what skateboarding did. So we watched a lot of that material in a way of like trying to work out the right path, you know?
Yeah.
So we definitely...
And with your path, competition-wise, like where are you fitting in on the national scale?
Yeah. I was Australia's like first competitive athlete. So I competed in the first world champ, or it was the second world champions, but I was the first Australian athlete to compete in that. And that was in London in 2009, going up almost 10 years actually. No, it's 10 years this year. Wow. 10 years since I competed in London. That's crazy.
Decade in, son.
Yeah, a decade and a half actually. So I was Australia's first competitive athlete. I competed in a few Red Bull competitions as well.
Yep.
I was never a strong competitive athlete. I couldn't say that I've been really happy in any of my performances on sort of like the international stage. I think that came from I've had a pretty... Well, I think my path replicates a lot of the majority of parkour athletes' path, in a sense of, because it's such a young sport, I've always had to work, well, most of my parkour career, I've had to work full time and do parkour on the side. So my training's always, in my early days, was very sporadic. I'd train really hard for three or four months, and then I'd have to go and work because I was like a nomad. I just wanted to travel. So
it's a lot with those extreme sports.
Yeah.
Like it's a lot of... you know, working hard, grind, and trying to earn some dollars so you can keep doing your passion and your love.
Exactly. Where there are a few athletes finally now that are able to live off the sport. And there were a few guys early on that were able to train really hard specifically for competition and never needed to work a full-time job. And those guys like Sean, they rose to the top really quick. And then like, you know, I got invited to the first world championships because I was like Australia's, the only known Australian athlete at the time. So I didn't necessarily at that point qualify for the world championships. I kind of just ended up there. I reckon one of the Art of Motion competitions I competed in, like I earned my spot for that. Like I was definitely at that point when I competed in Japan, I deserved to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably my best performance. For that competition, I was able to train specifically for that competition, and I'm happy with how I did in that competition. And then there was a Red Bull video competition that I competed in Q8. And my team in that actually came second. So obviously I was ready for that competition, but I stumbled on competition.
Who was your team?
I can't remember what we called ourselves, but it was made up of Ryan Doyle and Kai Willis and Vinny Coral, three old school guys.
Nice.
And we made this cool competition video, and we won this video. Or we came second in this video competition. I guess my point is that my parkour career has looked very much the way of like an early adopter, where I've done this passion for 15 years. I've built some really cool experiences, done amazing things, but I've always still had to tread between the lines and sort of work really hard while then also trying to be a competitive athlete and then building a company on the side. And so it's been a really interesting career, but I feel like that has helped lead the way for some of the next generation that are coming through now that can... You know, I started a company with my friends who now sponsors athletes. Yeah. So like what we built now,
building the foundation.
That's the one. Yeah. So now we've laid the path that the next generation can come through and make it their life, which is really cool.
Awesome, brother. So you've been getting around the globe.
Yeah.
Competition wise, but just traveling in general. And do you source out what, you know, other parkour individuals, like if you're going to get travel somewhere and the country and the spots that you might source out and why, just like...
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest...
Parkour. Like if you're looking at Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or Dubai and, you know, places like...
What we like to say, I think, in the parkour community is, I don't know if this is true or not, but what we say is that parkour was the first viral sport. So we feel like parkour was the first sport that grew because of the internet. And so it's very interconnected, right? So like when I was 14 or 15 on MSN Messenger, I'd be talking to athletes.
MSN Messenger.
Yeah, man. We go back. Yeah. You know, I'd be talking to a guy named Tim Sheaf, who's an ex-vegan now. And he's quite, you know, he was very famous in the vegan community and a very famous free runner. And I remember...
Well, now he's back on the meat.
Yeah, he is. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. We'll leave that one alone for this one. But he...
I love steaks.
Yeah. he's a very good, you know, he's an old school friend of mine. And, you know, I remember talking to him, you know, when we were like 14 or 15 on MSN. And then when I went over to England for the first time, we met up and I stayed with him. And that's what the parkour community has become. It's been this interconnected worldwide community where people meet on the internet and then eventually get to train with each other. And it's that pureness, it's that essence that I think people are very scared of losing because of things like the FIG, this gymnastics federation, because it has been this community sport that was really community first. And now the talks of the Olympics, we know what happens when these types of things start, it changes everything. So for me, my personal travels have always been, where I want to go to, I guess England was the first one. That trip, I reached out to all these people online and suddenly I was staying with people in Liverpool and London and Manchester and all these places. That's then I went awesome. To Spain and stayed with people there and Italy. And it's always been this community where like people will just put you up. Unfortunately, as the sport has grown, it's not quite as easy to do that anymore. But the next gen, it's not as easy to do it with people my age, like younger people coming and do it with my age. What's cool is the next generation has created their own foundation. And right. So all the guys that are like 21, they're all talking now and they're going to do what we did back then as well. So,
and it's a much easier reach now when you're looking at social media, when you're looking at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube and every other angle that they can hit on there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy world that we live in. I could only have dreamed of the things, the tools that we have available for us these days. Like Instagram is ridiculous, you know, YouTube is ridiculous. It's so cool. It's no better. There's never been a better time to be alive, to be like this new school nomadic creative person, you know, like
100%,
digital nomad, people like to call themselves. And,
I like that, digital nomad.
Yeah, that's the online slang is digital nomad. And all you have to do is have a camera, a microphone and a YouTube channel and
spread the love,
you know, with the right message, with the right vision, you can, yeah, this thing here can take you around the world. And that's what I dreamt of when I was a kid and have stumbled my way into it and done it quite well for over a decade. And now to watch these young
kids. You have, and it's exciting.
It is very exciting, man.
Yeah.
And now the next generation's taken to the next level. Like there's like kids that are 15 years old on the internet that are like making millions of dollars on their YouTube channel. Jeez. You know, it's such a cool time to be alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your favorite city and why?
I would say that is a loaded question because there's too many good cities around the world. I lived in Thailand for 5 years. So Bangkok is very high on the list.
That's a nice city.
Because
I love combat sports.
Yep.
Because
the Muay Thai.
Muay Thai. Yeah. For my 24th birthday. Yeah. My wife bought me a ticket for one of the main stadiums to go and watch it. A few fights down there and absolutely loved it.
That's cool.
It is.
It's like the epitome of like urban jungle. So it was like, oh my God, when I first stumbled across like Thailand when I was 19, I think the first time I went there, and I just vividly remember driving down the main street and just my eyes were just like, what? You know, like I'd grown up in Summerland Point on the central coast and I'm surrounded by lake and beaches, beautiful place. And then I like this grungy, dirty city with the lights on at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we go and get dinner at like at this place called Foodland at 2 a.m. and it's like this beautiful food, and I'm just like, there's food available at this time. Like, it was just, it was such a shock on the senses.
Yeah.
And it was, I spent the
just
next...
just the visuals, the smells, the textures, everything.
It was everything I dreamed of contrast, right? I'd always, I was so used to the Central Coast, and that was my whole subjective reality was the Central Coast. That's all I knew. And then I couldn't have been further away from home, you know, from a, like, everything was different. And I just fell in love with it. And so I spent the next half a decade just living there and learning about that culture and building a company with my friends. And
talking about building a company, so co-founder of Farang, so yeah, with this mob, who are they, the network of it, and what does it mean,
Farang? Yeah. Farang, the actual word is a Thai word for foreigner, so we're team foreigner, right? So at the time of inception, we were a German guy, an Australian guy, and a Thai guy, but he sort of has, like, he's Indonesian, Scottish, Portuguese, like, he's a mix of all types of places. So the Thai word Farang is quite a popular word over there, and it's sometimes used as a little bit of an insult, but really just used as a descriptive word. So it's like, you're a Farang, you're a white guy in Thailand. And so
you're
we kind
a gringo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah, we kind of reclaim the word a little bit, because we... in our head, it was sort of like we're all foreigners to somewhere, and Farang is a cool word, so we took it back, and then we called ourselves Team Farang. At the early days, we were making these really cool videos. We, the three of us, sort of had our own very small followings online. Like, I had like 8,000 YouTube followers. This was like 10 years ago. Jason had about the same, maybe a few more, and Anand had like similar as me. And we decided that we were going to put everything... we were like, all right, we've got these, I think at the time we're like, we've got these big followings of our own, and, but we're going to throw it all away and we're going to create this thing together. And we really hyped this like video, the city, and we spent months, we had a few of our other friends with us as well, some amazing athletes from all over the place, another Australian guy, some English guys, and we created this video called Team Farang, the city. And we hyped it really big and we put it online, and it got posted
YouTube?
And it got posted on Red Bull, and it got posted here and here, and it just blew up. We got hundreds of thousands of views really quickly. And so Anna and Jason and I at the time were like, all right, we're going to do this. Like, let's create this team. Let's create, but we're like, how are we going to make money? That was our first thought. It's like, okay, we're going to do this, but how are we going to stay here?
Because it's not that, like, at the end of the day, because it's your passion and it's your love, but you got to live too. So it's like, how do we, you know, make some monetary components off the back of what we want to do, because, you know, you can't keep doing it if there's no money flow coming in. So you got to eat at the end of the day.
That's correct. Yeah. So that was kind of what we thought as well. It was sort of, as I said, this was very early days, you know, for us in the parkour journey, and there wasn't many companies sponsoring people, and there wasn't other companies for us to get sponsored by at the time. But we actually stumbled across this German backpack company that sponsored us to wear their backpacks. They were called Fast Break. And so suddenly we were able to sort of stick around in Asia for a while, and that gave us an opportunity to actually create a clothing brand for ourselves. And that was our first sort of revenue source that we had control over, a little bit of money we were making off YouTube as well. And so we were able to sort of travel around Europe and Asia and create these videos. And that was sort of like
that is awesome.
Yeah. And this was like, as I said, this was 8-9 years ago now. So there wasn't a lot of people doing it at that time. And now it's like, yeah, it's a very common thing to see people with YouTube channels, and it's a really cool time to be alive, as I said.
Brother, you put this Instagram post up. It's been out for a while now.
Yeah.
But it gave me anxiety big time. And for the viewers out there, or I should say the listeners, sorry, but we'll get you to explain it a little bit more. But from what I've seen, I think you might be in Thailand. I think I can see the flag. But it looks like it's some sort of metal rig overpass where there's like a concrete channel drain.
Yeah.
You're like 30 feet up in the air. holding one hand in the middle.
I know the post.
In the middle with a backpack on. And I'm sweating, mate, just looking at that. Can you explain the thoughts and the processes of that?
Yeah.
That picture. And by the way, whoever took the shot, it looks awesome.
Shout out to Emily.
Emily.
Eddie Photo Eye. Yeah. Fantastic photographer.
Shout out.
From LA. Yeah. She's actually partner of Jason Paul, who was one of the founding members of Team Farang with me.
Nice.
So it's really cool because I guess that's where the lines start to get blurred between like artistry and movement.
And the strength that it would have took just to hold yourself on that.
Yeah. So this is, as I said, it's really cool because I know it's going to sound a little bit ridiculous, but for me, like that was quite easy. So that, like, in the terms of what I find challenging, even though there was some height aspect to it, like for me,
just a little bit of height.
It's quite a height. Yeah, but for me, like I could do that 100 times and not barely raise a sweat. Well, actually, I'm very sweaty because Thailand's so hot, but it's not something that pushes me that much.
Mm.
But from a
do you vision this before you do it? Like, do you think you're sitting down below looking at this thing from above?
Yeah.
And are you in first person sort of letting that go through your head?
Yeah, so that's how we train. Like, I guess that's where the segue there is that's what parkour training is sort of about, is about building comfort in the discomfort, right? So
it's all about taste of fear, brother.
That's it, you know, and
being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Being comfortable in uncomfortable situations.
That's it. And so I'm, you know, I do a lot of hanging. It's really good for your shoulders to just hang off bars, right? And my grip strength is quite good. So I know from my logic, you know, from my rational brain that I hang off bars every day and I never slip off them, right? It's not like I'm never in the gym and I'm hanging and then suddenly I just fall. So I think it's about bridging the gap, right? Is about making that connection that if I've hung off that bar 1,000 times in the gym and I've never fallen, then why would I fall when I'm 10 meters off the ground? It's like, it's irrational. It shouldn't happen.
Mm.
I think what happens, the reason that a lot of people do fall in those types of situations or why accidents do happen is because people, they don't believe in themselves, right? And
is it that just that little voice in the back of their mind? Yeah.
Yeah. It's the doubt. It's that self-dialogue. It's that hesitation that usually results in people falling or people having, and it's a huge generalization. I'm sure there's plenty of accidents that happen. People were sure of themselves, but from a training standpoint,
Because people get injured in all sorts of sports.
Exactly.
You know,
so exactly. And there's some things,
if it's team, individual, extreme, whatever.
Exactly. There's accidents happen all the time. Mm. But it's about mitigating that risk. And
that's right.
Exactly. And I know from my rational brain that, like, I can hang off a bar I did a 7-minute bar hang a couple of weeks ago, right? I hung from a bar from 7 minutes. So it's like, I know that that's a confident movement for me. So taking that off the ground shouldn't change anything from my own confidence.
Yep.
And like, it's, yeah. So that's the mentality going into something like that. And then because of people, I guess that it gets quite cool for people because then people don't think about that. All they see is me hanging off a bar, and it gives that emotional. It makes people's palms sweaty, and
more
and
than palms, mate.
You know. And so that's where, as a movement artist, it's like, it's really cool to create that art. I think it's cool. It's going to be really cool to print that and put it on my wall and look back at that one day.
Beautiful
and,
picture, mate.
And be proud of the physical capabilities that I had, you know, at this age. But
the mental part of it as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And what it took to go through that process.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking of, from a practical sense, because I'm just thinking of me as a quadriplegic with, like, does it help when you're hanging, like with your tendons and your shoulders and everything else? Like, what does that feel for you, like just hanging in general, apart from grip strength?
Yeah.
Because I'm just thinking how I could maybe apply it to myself, like just from me hanging from something.
100%, man. I guess it's very good for your shoulder and spinal health. sort of the lengthening of the spine and a health, just having
That's what I was thinking of, decompression.
Exactly. Decompression is the word.
Yeah.
And I think having healthy, strong shoulders has all types of benefits. I don't know if you, are you always in an electric wheelchair or?
Like 99% of the time, but I do have a manual chair, but it's got assisted motors in the wheels.
Yeah.
So when I push, it gives me three times the force.
Yeah.
So I get around in that. So I try and build up my shoulder strength and everything else, because sometimes I haven't done it for a while, but I get involved in quad rugby.
Yeah, that's cool.
Wheelchair quad rugby here and there. So I try and build that up so I can get in the chair and roll around with some of these guys. You know, I'm not as fast as some of them, you know.
Yeah.
As slow as a donkey, but, you know, I'll give it a crack, you know. So yeah,
that's awesome.
But it's all about being getting involved and having a go. So that's the main thing.
It's not an area of expertise of mine, but from my knowledge of the whole space, I feel like the grip strength, the shoulder health, the spinal health would be benefits for yourself for sure.
Yeah.
I couldn't see any negative things coming from it, if not only positives. Yeah. And outside that, it'd be really cool for you to do as well.
Yeah, I think you would enjoy it.
And just building that strength. And it's one of those things that you can track from start, you know, from I was here and now I'm here. I had a motorbike accident on my own a couple of years ago, and was, you know, at one point didn't have, you know, mobility of my arm and probably at one point
affected the nerves. Yeah.
Yeah. I damaged my brachial plexus nerve in my shoulder and had like full muscle atrophy of my bicep and lost my bicep altogether, and was kind of told that don't ever expect for your bicep to reform. And I know that the training that I've done, with it being a lot of hanging, has definitely helped. I've definitely exceeded expectations on the recovery that I should have had.
That's great.
Yeah. And the body is such a resilient, crazy thing, because I lost my bicep and was still doing pull-ups just because I shouldn't have been doing them. But what happened with my body proved to me that you can't always listen word by word to what the doctors say.
Just having that mental determination, and sometimes what the mind can overcome and what it can produce in the body, you know?
Well, from a practical standpoint, what happened is because I kept doing pull-ups, my forearm developed in a way that I'd never seen before. So because I was pulling still and I had no bicep and no bicep strength, my forearm became overdeveloped and I was out like this in my forearm. And what happened was, as my brachial plexus nerve started to heal slowly and my bicep started to form, it was almost in proportion that the more my bicep grew, my forearm was shrinking. So it was like my body told me, okay, I know what you're doing. We're just going to build a muscle that's working to help you. And then it just balanced back out. And like, if I had told that to any physio before that I was going to go do that, and then told him that happened after, the advice would have been not to do that before, because I did speak to a physio and he said, you know, you guys don't get back to that pulling exercise. You should do these exercises. And I was like stubborn and I was like, no, I'm just going to go and do pull-ups because that's all I knew. And then my body just adapted to it. And that's like that's my experience. I've experienced that with my body. So, I mean, I can only imagine that like someone else's body would react really good, you know, with a different problem than I had. There'd be something cool that could possibly come out of it, you know. And I mean, I would love to see you try some of that stuff.
Get up, start hanging, get those shoulders working.
Yeah.
So with the Movement Collective.
Yeah.
So what's your role with that? So you teach there, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a guy from Newcastle. His name's Rod Cooper, and very cool guy, very fit, active, amazing handstander. And him and his girlfriend Jenny are running a facility up in Newcastle called the Movement Collective. Where do I start? So movement as a practice is something that's sort of on the tip of everyone's tongue right now.
And the culture of it.
Exactly. And there's a lot of parallels with parkour, which is why I kind of and very attracted to it and was drawn into it. And Rod and I used to communicate with each other online when I was living in Sweden for a while, and we would sort of always comment on each other and DM each other and be like, that's really cool, and that's really cool. And we'd always had it planned in our heads that when I came back, we'd do some training together. And they opened a new facility in Waratah in Newcastle. And I went to the opening and we just hit it off. And he invited me straight away. He's like, all right, you're going to come teach with me. And so he invited me up. And I run like a strength and agility class, I call it up there. And it's kind of has fundamentals built around parkour, but it's really to help build, yeah, strength and agility.
And with, core. And,
yeah, a lot yeah. of core stuff. And what's really cool is the movement community is very open to my style of teaching. And so my role up there at the moment is I teach these strength and agility classes. And it's really cool because I enjoy teaching adults because I love teaching kids as well, but I love when you explain something to someone and you watch it go over in their head, especially people, older people who have maybe moved away from a movement practice. You know, yep. We all, as kids, we know what it means to move. And then we get older and we start an office job and we stop moving so much.
Yeah.
And then to watch someone reconnect with movement later on in life and then get excited about something like parkour in their 30s or 40s, to be the person that gives that back to them is like, it's a really nice thing. And then to watch them progress and watch them do things that at first were very hard for them and then it becomes a lot easier for them. It's a really satisfying thing to guide people through. So I really just love teaching up there. I've had to step away for a little bit because I've currently going through some knee problems right now that I'm working through. So teaching's not the most practical thing for me right now, but I just love the movement culture and it's a really cool space. And Rod is an amazing human being that if you get the chance, you should maybe try and bring him on as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So where is it?
It's in Waratah in Newcastle near the Knight Stadium.
Address?
Crescent Road.
Crescent Road.
Waratah 2/something, I think.
Just Google it, it will pop up.
The Movement Collective.
And so within that facility, is that where you do most of your training? Or I'm just thinking from a perspective as a parkour athlete when you're trying to train and like build yourself up with your core and your muscles and everything else and the mental aspect of it as well. So is it just strictly, say, training in a facility like the Movement Collective, or do you get into a gym like a general gym also, like doing, you know, just general curls and normal stuff like that? Or what's the core training of a parkour athlete?
So we want to have a good power to weight ratio, so we want to stay relatively light. So a lot of sort of body weight training is very good. Calisthenics, all that sort of stuff is really good for training. I enjoy weightlifting myself, you know, your squats, deadlifts, bench press, your five sort of fundamental exercises that can help build progressive overload over time, strength, you know. Mm-hmm. So overhead press, bench press, squats, deadlifts, and rows. Like when I want to build strength, I'll go back to those five fundamental exercises and build up. Then what the Movement Collective's added to my training is an emphasis on mobility.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of the small muscles that support the bigger ones, because obviously when you're doing rows, you know, that's building, you know, within the lats and some of the back major muscles. Yeah. But then when you're going back to the Movement Collective, where you got some of that core, it's some of those little smaller muscles that are supporting the bigger ones.
Yeah, so that's where the calisthenics training really comes into play. A lot of body weight exercises help build that. A lot of quadrupedal movements, so like moving like lizard crawls. And
is that sort of like the Otto Portal?
Exactly, you've hit it on the, yeah, exactly. So Rod was on Otto Portal's program for a while.
Nice.
So a lot of his fundamentals come from that. And then I would say what I've added to my training more over the last couple of years is dynamic, like a lot of sort of building strength within stretching, so side splits, and building my flexibility and building strength within my flexibility. So a lot of what do you call it? Like,
is that
ballistic stretching and trying to find range within flexibility and mobility that I didn't have before. And it's really opened up a new part of my training.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've really taken away from the Movement Collective. And then, yeah, so I probably do like 30% of my training at the Movement Collective, 30% probably within a traditional gym, and then the next 40% would be actual just parkour itself.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So that's sort of my breakup. Then
is that sort of like a generalization across the board?
Yeah. I do. If I was training for a competition a couple of months ago, which has resulted in the injury that I have right now, but when I did program, I spoke to a strength coach who is a physio before that training, and he programmed a 12-week program for me moving up to the competition. So if it's more like, if I've got something coming up that I want to train for, I will speak to someone that has more knowledge than myself. But if I'm just trying to maintain and just stay like able to do parkour, then I'll do that sort of, I like to do things that I enjoy as well. So that's sort of like the split that I, cause then maybe one night a week I'll go and do gymnastics as well. Or night a week I'll go and play tennis, you know, it's like whatever.
Gymnastics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, stay away from.
Yeah. But yeah, I wanted to ask you actually, I wanted to have a quick conversation with you about, cause I know that you're Aboriginal.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a music video a couple of years ago, of an Aboriginal rapper, and he was, I think, in Northern Territory, and there was in the background, he had this really cool music video in the background. There was some Aboriginal kids doing like acrobatic, like they were doing like tumbling in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And it really sparked my head, got my brain thinking about some of the communities out there and how parkour may appeal to some of those kids. And yeah, I just wanted to ask you what you think about that, or if there's any way to get involved with some of those communities and go and try and take parkour to them.
Mate, there could be definitely opportunities to get parkour out to the broader community.
Yeah.
And it's funny you say that, because it'd be a bit of a mix too, because where you got sort of urban environments, not as urban as what we live in along the eastern, I really should say along the coastline of Australia, where most of Australians live. But as you go inland, you know, there's less infrastructure.
Yeah.
So then it'd be a mix of running through, you know, the bush, doing it through there, and then mixing it up within town.
Yeah.
So that's something we could definitely
talk
about, take down the line.
Have you watched Ninja Warrior?
I have watched Ninja Warrior.
The Deadly Ninja Warrior. You know Deadly?
I know Deadly.
Yeah. Like he,
Have you talked to him or?
I haven't actually, because I actually competed in this season of Ninja Warrior, the season that just went
by. I'm not sure what Mobby's from, because myself, I'm a Wanawura Kamilaroi man.
Yeah.
I don't know what. Yeah.
Because I've seen he's been out doing some stuff with some communities and taking the Ninja Warrior stuff out there, and it's been like really popular, you know. Yeah. And you can see he shows up, and all the kids love it. And it's just even because one of the projects I'm working on right now is workshops. I'm teaching these workshops that I'm actually,
because I know a lot of community, especially like when I'm Kamilaroi, they're the second biggest tribe in New South Wales.
Yeah.
Spans a lot of country out there, like Wiradjuri, that's the biggest one in New South Wales.
Yeah.
And that's like out Dubbo, Wellington Way, and that spans a lot of country. But I know mob from all over, not just this state, all around the nation. So definitely, you know, we can tee something up, you know, off air.
Yeah.
And, keep this dialogue open and just see where we can roll through some communities
for sure,
and I spread the love of parkour.
That's it, yeah. And I just want it because I'm doing these workshops, and it's mainly tailored for adults, the ones that I'm doing at the moment. But I'd love to come up with something that I could travel around and deliver to, not just Aboriginal communities as well, just all types of communities around Australia. You know, like especially some of the rural stuff. That's what I'm, because as an Australian, I haven't seen enough of my own country. I don't understand. I feel like I kind of went off and saw the rest of the world, and I don't.
A lot of people do that. You know, they go, they do Europe before they've been out of their own state. You know what I mean?
That's it. And it's sometimes once you've been around, away for a while, you kind of realize what you had at your front doorstep, you know, and there's so much culture and it's so rich of culture and beautiful, you know, beautiful nature, beautiful beaches. And like, oh, I'm like,
and I see that a lot just recently when I had my trip in Victoria, just seeing the 12 apostles. And, you know, that was magic. You know, when we're there with, it was my wife and I, and just that experience of just natural beauty. And, you know, the thousands of years that it would have took for those rock formations to form.
Yeah.
But really now there's only probably about 7.5 because they're falling down.
You're saying.
But just to witness that and be a part of that and just going along the Great Ocean Road.
Yeah.
Just, you know, where you're at sea level. And we're pretty lucky when we're driving because we're getting crystal clear days. Like, and like the water was crystal as well. So when we're driving along, we're at sea level. And there's people out in the surf. And, you know, I was pretty lucky to, and I'm the passenger, so I felt bad for my wife at some points when we're driving through because I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing this bloke getting a 20-metre barrel crystal clear, you know, at sea level. And all of a sudden we're hugging a cliff and it's getting a little bit precarious. And, and then all of a sudden you're going through like a rainforest and then it's bit of a pine forest and then back out to the ocean. And man, we've got a beautiful country around here, Australia, that's for sure.
Yeah, and just
and we can implement something like that when you're talking about getting out of the community and not just the Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders. If you're getting out there, you're getting within community itself. If it's Aboriginal and every other culture in between, you know, it doesn't matter if they're black, white or brindle, you know, bringing everybody together and getting that love of the sport and the culture and the mindset of parkour.
I like it. Let's tee it up for sure.
100%.
We were talking a little bit before and we didn't go too far in it, but what happened? How did you end up a quad?
Yeah, so with my accident, which with me being a quad, being a C5, C6, incomplete quadriplegic, and incomplete means like my spinal cord wasn't fully severed. So that's where, and it happened here. So it happened out in the backyard. So had a pull and it was on my 25th birthday and I don't, and like I've, the particular spot where I dove off, I'd done it 1,000 times, but it was just a weird angle that I dove off. And it wasn't me hitting the bottom of the water. It was the force of the water where it sort of pushed my head back and the vertebrae had just pinched on the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. So then the spinal cord swelled up and then, you know, affected the nerves and left me as a quadriplegic, you know. I was pretty full on, so just being 25.
Mm-hmm.
And not just for me, for my wife and my family and friends and the whole inner circle there, and going through ICU and, you know, one of my left lung collapsed because change of breathing apparatus, and because I went through it was pretty much a whole year of trying to know and feel what quadriplegia is and having a spinal cord injury and how am I going to adapt into this new life, and not just me, my wife and everybody else around me. And that's why, you know, going back in a taste of fear, it's about, you know, trying to, because I get in these uncomfortable situations all the time being a quad, and that's where it's where spasms are setting off, or where I'm, and I'm constantly learning still.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though I'm a decade in, like, there's new situations where I'm feeling uncomfortable, but I want to try and feel comfortable within the uncomfortable situation. And that's...
You're speaking my language.
Yeah. And that's where it's... if it's a physical thing or it's a mental game. Because just say recently where I had... my appendix taken out,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty full on because, and what was indicating that going on in my body was my spasms were really kicking in, And I thought it was a UTI, like a urinary tract infection, because quads and paras and usually get those things. Like, I've only had like two in my whole life of being a quad, so I'm pretty lucky because I'm really healthy and look after myself. Like, I'm really diligent on that, you know, because I've got it to do with work and just being to get up in general and pressure areas and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and then I had, and the spasms were kicking in, thought it was a UTI, went to the doctors, got on the antibiotics. These spasms are still out of control and I was really washed out, and my wife is like, you got to go to the hospital. And, you know, I'm pretty stubborn on myself and I'm like, yeah, I better get up there. So then when we got up to hospital, that's when I had the CAT scan and had the contrast run through me. That's where they had the colouring run through when I go through the CAT scan. And then like, well, he's got a perforated appendix.
Mm.
And that's when I had the surgeons come in and they're like, oh, we're going to have to wait till tomorrow because we're going to have a full team around because I'm a complex patient. So that's where went in the next day, 3.5 hours later, to have laparoscopic surgery to take the gangrenous appendix out and a centimetre of bowel.
Mm.
And so then after that, and then I had that taken out and, you know, and then I spent a week in the intensive care unit in Wong, and awesome team there and got really looked after. So shout out to the team at Wong Hospital. And went through that, got home and still been having spasms. And so I went to the hospital a few times and looking into that, and the spasms are still going. And so when, just before I went to my trip to Melbourne or Victoria, so, and shout out to Phil at Independent Mobility and Rehab, because my legs were kicking around. I'm like, I'm going to have to get something to hold my feet down. Yeah. So I ended up coming around and putting some ankle huggers on my around my ankles so I could hold my feet down. So, and that was a godsend. So when I was on my trip, so that was able to hold my legs down when we were going through Victoria. Yeah. So I was able to wheel around and not get thrown around too much. And even when I was on my trip, like, because my wife done my care for the 2 weeks, so she spotted when she was doing my, she's like, what's going on here? And had a look at one of my scars. And like, there was a bit of the stitch like pushing itself out. And so when we come back from Victoria, went to the hospital and talked to the doctors there. And then they ended up just cutting off the suture because they looked at the whole report. And they explained to me that it can take, you know, 4 to 6 months for these stitches to dissolve. So that can be a matter of the case where some of these stitches, where they're still holding on to nerves, that's why the spasms are still kicking off that the way they are, because... And then I ended up just last week just going to see my spinal doctor down at Royal Ride Rehab. And that, because that's where I was 10 years ago, when I went through my whole ordeal of going through the rehabilitation process, and talked to him about it, about, you know, additional medication and stuff like that, and talked to him about that, and that's where that can be the case. So, but just got to ride it out and see within the next couple of months with the spasms, see where they ease out. But, you know, I just got to keep eating right, doing the right thing, exercising, looking after myself, and just seeing where it goes from there. So, but talking about injuries, so, because you blokes, well, I shouldn't just say blokes, gals too,
yeah,
you's put yourselves through some pretty precarious situations there. So what's the injury list with you, brother, with the whole parkour scene there?
It's really interesting because... From a parkour perspective, I've not had that many injuries. You know, I can see the irony of me doing this sport that some see as an adrenaline junkie sport. And I've never really hurt myself. And then I came quite close to, let's say, like dying in a motorbike accident. So it was like I've done this crazy sport for so many years and been fine. And then I jump on a motorbike and almost die. And the thing is, I guess that's where some misconceptions come in about parkour is it is trained at low level most of the time. So, you know, it's like from a practical standpoint, a parkour training looks less like jumping between buildings and more like jumping between two curbs on the side of the road, you know. And it's like one of those memes, it's like expectations versus reality. It's like my real life meme is that people think I spend all my time up there and I spend most of my time down here. And so, and because of the knowledge that it can be dangerous, you know, we train a lot of strength training. I would say that more excessively than a lot of different sports. I mean, there's a huge emphasis on safe training within parkour. So as a generalization, it's not a super dangerous sport. I mean, I could list five of the top athletes that I know, you know, just off the top of my head, and none of them are broken bones doing parkour.
Yeah, right.
So as I said, generalization, but it's usually trained pretty safely. So I haven't really done any serious injuries doing parkour itself. I am having some knee problems right now, which are definitely a symptom of 15 years of parkour. And it's the first time I've come across these particular injuries, and it's kind of knocked me off because I was in the best shape I'd ever been in like 6 months ago. And I was really at the top of my game and was like just turned 30 years old and was like, hey man, I'm 30 and I'm still doing this and talking to people and did a couple of podcasts and stuff. And I was like, yeah, man, like I'm 30 and I'm good. And then like, boom, 6 months later, I'm like sitting here and I'm like, yeah, my knees are not that good. So there's an overarching problem I'm trying to deal with there. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm quite confident that I've got some MRI scans coming back next week, and hopefully I'll know what's going on then. And
well, I hope that all works.
It's more just being in the dark where like I don't know what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, you know, fear of the unknown.
Exactly. And so it's like more thinking about what could be wrong rather than practically thinking.
Yep.
And there's like a lot of so much going into research of psychology, the psychology of the body these days, and the power of the brain and what it can do to your body when you have these self-limiting beliefs. And so there's a point where about 3 months ago, I was having some knee problems, some leg problems, and the emotional side kicked in a little bit. And I think I perpetuated the problem a little bit by thinking that I had a problem. And then I got a real problem because of the problem I thought I had, you know? Yeah. And so I'm trying to work through the emotional and the physical at the same time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's some of those types of things that you've been through as well.
100%. Yeah. Because it's a lot of the time I put myself in mental states where where I think it does affect the body.
Yeah.
Where if it's got to do with spasticity or anything else that's related to quadriplegia, I think that really helps me. But that's just me and my perspective. Like every other quad or para or other disability handles it differently. But I think, you know, the mind's a powerful thing. Yeah. And I think it can strengthen the body.
You'd like this. I have a friend, Matt Armitage, his name is. He's an old school parkour friend from Liverpool in the UK. And he lost a limb in a motorbike accident about a year and a half ago. So I believe it was right leg down from the knee down. And he's got an artificial leg now. The technology's getting pretty good. It's basically replaced his leg. This guy is like less than 2 years after his accident, and he's like legitimately doing like, he's doing acrobatics again. Like full on, like, I think he's like reaching the level he was at. He hadn't been training before his accident. So I think he's like quickly approaching like the level he was at before the accident. And it's been incredible to watch him because I saw it from day one. Like the post came up on Facebook.
That he's Australian?
He's not. He's an English guy.
No. He's in England. Yeah, sorry.
But to watch him from like, because he had to make the decision to have it amputated, So there was a chance that they could save the leg, but I think it would have not have healed properly. So he would have always had like a non-functioning leg, but he would have got to keep it. And he made the really hard decision to be like, all right, we'll just take the leg off. And then to watch him go through it, like this Facebook posts that were coming through, you could tell.
It's pretty hardcore.
I can only imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine the pain that he went through to, yeah.
Yeah. Because I've seen the same things. Like when I've gone through rehab, like a person that I know that I went through rehab with was in a car accident. And he's a para, but there was flames involved and wear that burnt the legs and, you know, the decisions trying to save the legs and, you know, and then gangrene has set in and all sorts of stuff like that. And it was just a full-on process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and even when the legs get lopped off, like what's crazy, like how the bones can keep growing as well. And you got to keep on top of that.
Yeah.
Like if they keep going and then you got to have further operations to... You know, I don't know what the correct term would be, but, you know, to grind the bones back down.
Shout out to Matt. But to see him, what he's done in the last 2 years, it's like the mind, man, the power of the mind. Super, super strong guy.
Yeah.
And shout to watch this guy that's like 2 years in from losing a limb and he's like tumbling again. I just like every time his posts come up on Facebook, it just like, yeah, it blows my mind. And then I think these self-limiting beliefs we can have sometimes, it's like, what can we do when we don't have them? You know, that's what I'm really into right now. Like, is really trying to work out how I can work through some of my own self-limiting beliefs. Some of the ones I had from my own accident as well, where it's like, I can't do this, or I'll never be able to do this again. And it's like, actually, yes, I can, you know, like you just, if I, you know, yeah, it's just a lot of prep and a lot of pushing through the fear for me, man.
That's it. And, mate, there's nothing but positive vibes that come out of you, brother. Like, you can feel it when you walk through the door. You can feel it now. Mate. And what I see is, like, and how you spread that out also from what I've seen on social media, like how you try and get mobs down to the beach and, you know, clean it up and get people involved to clean up the general environment that we live in, you know, instead of... Because you're just seeing people that just don't respect where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mainly in the natural parts where if it's a beach, if, you know, the forest or whatever it may be, and seeing what you do there. So do you want to explain a little bit there? Because I'm loving what you're doing in respect to that.
Yeah, man. I definitely went through a period of time, especially... I mean, we all go through crazy stuff, and I think everyone has their adversity that they go through, and it shapes you and it shapes your character. And I think what I've learned from my own things that happened was that
strength born in misery.
Yeah, that's it, man. And it's more living the life where you've embraced. There was definitely a fork in the road with whatever adversity I went through, if you want to call it that, whatever journey I went through, because we all go through it, right?
Mm.
And I think what I learned, there was the fork in the road, and I believe you'd be able to relate to this more than most people. It was like a choice that I made that I could either let the thing that happened to me become my story and become my inner dialogue or narrative, let's call it. And just live that life of, you know, where we grew up, you know, what it's like here, you know, it's a beautiful part of the world, but it's tough around here sometimes, you know, and I could have let that become my narrative and be like, yeah, I grew up here and this happened to me. And then I had this close to success and then I had this accident and everything went away and, you know, end up at the RE at 40, telling the story to everyone with my own sorrow. Or it was learn the lesson, take everything that I've learned from and try and get to a point where I can maybe have these conversations with people and share some of my experiences and maybe help pull some of the people that are going through similar stuff out and tell them that, like, if you have the right mindset and you believe in yourself that you can overcome whatever adversity, big or small, you're going through. Everyone's problems are their biggest problems to themselves, right?
That's it. And it's good if you can put that, throw that seed out. And if that helps that person, even if it's, you know, 5%, 10%, you know, 50%, if it's something, if it's going to make that little bit of difference.
Where what's taken a lot of work is getting to a point where I can talk about this and have these conversations in a way that, you know, like I didn't have a lot of self-belief. It's incredible. Some people would think it's amazing when I say this, but like I didn't have a lot of belief in myself for like the longest time.
Mm.
Like my own self-value was low at like throughout a lot of my early 20s. You know, I was just confused. I didn't know where I belonged in the world. I made a lot of bad decisions and did things I shouldn't have done. Mm. Like we all do, you know, and I've realized that we all go through this. And then it's gotten to the point now where like finding communities all over the place and realizing that they're so important for us. You know, I'm sure you've got some very strong communities in your life and that's where you find value. And then really being empowered by the people around me and realizing that like what good can you put into the world and learning that every action does, you know, it's like a universal truth that every conversation that you have, every interaction you have with people, like you have an impact on the world every time you do that. Like I'm saying, like, I believe that every interaction you have with somebody literally changes the world, and that it's within my power every day to just even through my little interactions make the world a better place. And it's you know, like it just compounds. You know, I go to these meditation sessions on Newcastle Beach sometimes.
I need to do more of that for myself, 100%.
And I look around and there's 200 people on a beach meditating.
Yeah, right.
And I think about the compounding energy generation of 200 people putting that much positivity out into the world. You can't, it's not tangible. I can't say this is what you're changing, but to have 200 people that are thinking a certain way, then going back out to interact with the world. And, you know, I was working some retail work recently and, you know, like the interactions that you have there, you know, you see some people come in some days and they're so angry and you're able to just maybe dilute that a little bit and turn that around where this person comes in, where they're interacting with every person in their life, like in this angry way. And then you can turn them around. They walk out of the store and they're happy. Like they're the small impacts that you can make, you know? And that's where, once again, like cleaning up the beaches, man, it's like, you've obviously seen that and you're like, that's a really good thing.
Mm.
So without me having to be going out, because I wrote this poem after I cleaned the beach and I was going to put it out there and be like, yeah, like I want to get this viral and get everyone. I was like, you know, the way to change people's opinions on things isn't to go and tell everyone that they're wrong. It's not like, go, hey, like, where are you cleaning up the beach? Like, why are you using single-use plastics or why are you doing this? When you tell everyone that they're the problem, like everyone gets defensive. It's human nature to be like, no, I'm not the problem. We're all the problem, you know, and you get caught in these loops.
And you see that a lot online, you know, whether it's trolls or just people that just have that negative perspective and just want to throw heat at you.
Exactly. And so I believe that actions, your own actions are the best way to make that impact. I'm fortunate enough to have 50,000 people that follow me on Instagram. So if I go out and I clean the beach and I just put a little bit out there and say, hey, this is what I'm doing, maybe that'll have an impact for a couple of hundred of my followers. And maybe
100%.
10 of those people will go and do that themselves. But then the network grows. If it's
something, that's it. The network grows. Exactly. And then they talk to that person, hey, Sean's doing this or seeing this guy doing this. Hey, let's give this a go. Let's clean this part of the, you know, the beach up or whatever the environment may be, you know.
That's it.
It's all about spreading that network and love, brother. But, mate, I love that. But I tell you what I love too, this whole Ninja Warrior stuff.
Yep.
Tell us about that experience and how'd you go?
Yeah, so it's a love-hate relationship, I guess. No, it's the world we live in, right? So
yeah. And Ninja Warrior is a show on Channel 9.
Yeah, it is.
It is on Channel 9?
It's Channel 9. It's a fantastic show and I've been a long-time fan.
Obstacle course.
What happened to me this season is that I did quite well. I made the semifinals, but I didn't make the cut. So I didn't actually get aired on the show. Didn't get any airtime. Still a very cool, amazing, incredible experience. That's why I say it's a bit love or hate, because it was like, went through this whole process expecting this like airtime and then didn't get any airtime. But it's not a big thing. I didn't do it just to, you know, get on national TV.
Yeah, hey, I'm Sean Wood. Yeah. Well, this is me on Ninja Warrior.
It would have been nice.
Yeah.
It would have been nice for
because there still shows like what, you know, and then that comes back to you who you are, a part of the movement collective and everything that you
exactly.
do.
Exactly. It could have been a powerful tool.
That's it. Yeah. The ethos behind that, you know, to spread that. And even coming down to cleaning the beaches.
Yeah.
It's all that where the eyes would be looking at that and where it spreads the network out.
Yeah. It's very interesting though. It was a great experiment in like sort of, you know, network television versus like this ability for us to sit here and have this conversation.
Mm.
And it's kind of like parkour was to me early on. It's like
telling the truth.
Yeah. I went back to this like network television type thing and it's in someone else's control, right? Like the whole process is like they wanted to create, you know, they created really good television. The show is amazing, but they get to choose what comes out, where like we have this ability through these conversations to do it ourselves.
Mm.
And that's where like there's this old school versus new school battle going on right now, where you have these big TV shows and these big networks, and then you have this ability to sit down and have a podcast between the two of us.
Mm.
And these are the two worlds that are sort of going.
It's interesting to see the evolution of it and just the battle. I suppose you'd say the battle between the both, because you know, when you got the Netflix and you know, when you got the standard TV, and then just how, well, you've seen it like with Fox, how they've sold X amount to, you know, to Disney, and now Disney owns Stan, and they're doing their own digital networks, and everything's going digital, and you know, and radio's sort of going down because of podcasts and everything else in between. So,
but to answer your question, Ninja Warrior, it was a very interesting, great, positive, one of the best experiences I've ever had. You having a parkour background helped me a lot. I kind of overtrained the wrong, I thought my strength was going to be a problem, and it wasn't. That wasn't the problem. It was like these sidewood lashes. But what I like to say is it was my rookie year, right? It's like very few NFL players on their rookie year like become the biggest player in the world, right? Like you got to have your rookie season.
Mm.
And that
would like say the Jared Haynes or the Valentine Holmes that come from not knowing it, throwing them into the mix and just,
exactly. And with the crazy thing about Ninja Warrior is that you don't get to see you see the course once and then you don't get to try it before.
I was wondering how that works.
Yeah. So you don't get to try it at all. So the first time I touched the course was my run, and I did well in the first round. And then the second round, I just slipped up on this sidewoods lache. Some of the guys that are doing really well right now are like three seasons in, and some of them have like done the shows overseas as well. So they've like had the opportunity to try the course, go train for it, try the course, go train for it, where it was kind of my first season where I trained with what I thought was going to be right. And then, so I feel like if I get an opportunity to go again.
Especially if you get to train it, because that seems a bit unfair if you got.
No. So what I'm saying is that they've tried the course, they failed it. Then they had a whole year of prep.
Ah, oh, okay. Righto.
But now they know what the course feels like, so they know how to train for it. Where like for me, I was coming in blind. I hadn't ran the course before. So it was kind of a lot of assumptions of what it would feel like. And it was totally different than what I thought it would be. So now if I have this year to prepare for the next season.
I was going
to
say, if the opportunity's there.
I would, yes, 100% yes. I'm back. Well, you got to go through the qualification process again. But I reckon I can get back on and give it another shot.
You hear that, Ninja Warrior?
Right, I'm coming for Mount Midori Armor.
It's coming. Coming in hot, coming in hard. Righto. So, shout-outs, social media handles.
Yeah.
Throw it out in the atmosphere, brother.
Yeah, you can follow me on all platforms under either Sean Wood or Sean R. Wood, some variation of that. I'll probably come up somewhere close to the top. And probably check out my blog if you want to get to know a little bit more about me. It's theallgood.blog. So www.theallgood.blog. That's where I like to write some blogs sometimes about different things that I'm going through with like concepts like this creative resistance or could be like camera recommendations. I'm a huge camera nerd. And then some parkour related topics there. And then all my videos are there, my Instagram. So it's my little passion project at the moment is the allgood.blog. And I've got some people reaching out to me now. They want me to sort of some other websites that want me to do some stuff for them. So,
nice.
And then, yeah, I just put in, once this injury is I'm able to overcome this injury, I'll be back to my Instagram content and just putting some stuff up there. I'm about to hit the road again for a couple of months. And next year I'm going to be on the road for a while. So yeah, if you're interested, if you want to follow the stuff that I'm doing, yeah, Sean Wood or theallgood.blog.
The All Good. So is there any other last messages that you want to throw out in the atmosphere? You know, maybe for some of these young parkour ninjas that are coming up through the scene, or just anybody in general that, you know, may resonate with what we've talked about today.
I feel a little bit of pressure here.
Just zen, think about it for a minute. You're all right, all good.
Yeah, all good, I like that. yeah, I mean, probably more for, I feel like, for any of you kids from the Central Coast or Newcastle that have, you know, this desire to do more, you know, it's like, I would say just follow your gut. Follow your head less, more your gut. You know, the more I start listening to my intuition rather than my rational brain, the better things go in my life. Yeah, so just getting in touch with that intuition and following that a little bit more.
That's beautiful, brother. Well, tell you what, I hope that knee and everything else heals up, MRI comes back, it's all sweet, get the health back up, and then we'll be seeing you. You know, getting you into that, hopefully we can formalize, get something with getting you out of the communities and all that sort of stuff.
That would be awesome.
And getting back on Ninja Warrior.
That's it. Mount Thank
Panorama.
You. Thank Come you for on. Having me on, man. And I really love what you're doing, and I can't wait to see this grow and
Cheers,
watch it.
Brother.
I'll be watching no matter where I'm at.
Dude, want to get you back on. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
You.
Boom. See, folks, like I said, you could feel the energy off Mr. Sean Wood. Awesome dude. Great yarn. Look forward to getting him on again. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So if you want to contact or follow me, you can get me on Instagram at Street Rolling Cheetah, or via email, one word, streetrollingcheetah@gmail.com. It's alrighto. We'll see you on the next one.